Hit it.
Welcome to the Test Talks Podcast, the place to go to geek out on software testing. And now your host, whose mission is to help you succeed with test automation, Joe Colantonio.
Hey, it's Joe, and today's episode is going to be a little bit different. Since it's getting near the end of the year, I thought I'd share with you the test automation playbook presentation I gave at the RDEV conference in Sweden this November. I think it sums up all the lessons and good practices I've picked up from being blessed to be able to interview some of the biggest names in the testing and automation field this year on Test Talks. Also, at the beginning of last year, one of my goals was to be able to actually speak in public for the first time by becoming a speaker at a conference. This is something I've been wanting to do for a long time, but honestly, being a naturally introverted guy, I'm scared to death to speak in public. And actually, most people that actually pull me aside in public are like, this guy doesn't even talk. What's going on here? So I was about to actually let this goal slide by until I got an invite to speak from Einar, a member of the program committee for the RDEV conference, one of the biggest developer conferences in Europe. So, you know, I really took this as a sign that this was time for me to do this, no matter how bad it turned out, no matter how scared I was. So this is the actual recording of my first ever presentation in public. And I actually had a lot of fun doing it. And I think the audience learned something from it. So I got good feedback. So I was pleasantly surprised. So maybe in 2016, I'll be doing even more speaking engagements. We'll see. So I hope you like it, but before we check it out, let's hear it for our awesome sponsor, Sauce Labs. Test Talks is sponsored by the fantastic folks at Sauce Labs, the cloud-based automated testing platform that eliminates the need to maintain your own Selenium grid and test infrastructure. Try it for free today. Visit testtalks.com and click on the Sign Up Now link under the homepage sponsor section.
So I'm Joe from joecolantonio.com and testtalks.com, a blog and podcast dedicated to all things test automation related. And today I want to share with you some actionable automation awesomeness you can put into play right away to help you succeed with your test automation efforts. So I used to always wish that there was a way that I could rotate from company to company every 3 months to find out what worked and, more importantly, what didn't work for other engineers within their companies and organizations. But rather than leave my job every 3 months, I decided to start a podcast where I get to interview some of the biggest names in the testing and development field. So this presentation really is a combination of what I've learned in my 15 years of experience and what I've learned from interviewing 70-plus developers and testers. This is one of my favorite quotes from Test Talks, from Dima Kovalenko, and he actually wrote a book on Selenium design practices. And I really believe there is nothing more soul-crushing than having your tests fail all over the place. There's nothing more annoying than tests failing and you don't know why. And I think everyone that's done test automation for any amount of time have felt this way, but I think there's certain things you could focus on to make your test automation efforts even better so that we feel this way less often. And so the three phases I want to focus on the planning phase of test automation, the writing phase, and the execution phase. So probably 3 years ago, I was mostly known as an HP test tool vendor automation engineer using HP's LoadRunner, QTP, ELM. And then I started working with more open source tools on the side. So when I heard about another company looking for an engineer to lead the efforts using Selenium, C#, and SpecFlow, I jumped at the chance. But little did I know I was actually jumping into a pit of doom. This group had been running for 8 to 9 months. They had two sprint teams. And they outsourced the automation of all their tests. So they had an offshore team that was just creating automated test after automated test. And when we finally got it in-house and tried to run in a continuous integration environment, it didn't work. It didn't run. So we had thousands of tests that didn't work in our CI environment. And there were a lot of reasons for why this project wasn't that successful. And the main one was they really didn't have a framework. And so in the planning phase, you shouldn't build out a whole solution from beginning to end. You should create basically a skeleton of what you want your framework to look like, what layers you're going to split it up into, how you're going to name things, naming conventions, what your process is going to be. And this may seem pretty trivial, but if you have that skeleton in place, if you work with a lot of teams like I do, I work with 8 to 10 sprint teams, When you roll this out, everyone will be doing the same thing. If you have 8 to 10 sprint teams creating automation however they want to, it's going to be a nightmare to maintain. And that's really the key to be successful with automation. It needs to be maintainable. And one way to maintain is to make sure you have a framework in place, at least the skeleton of it. A good example of where this came into good use for me was I created a very high-level framework with just some bare minimum code to it. And I ran it through the process as a proof of concept with a test. And when we got into our company's continuous integration environment, I found out that they had a company policy that enforced a different standard than what I used for my framework. So if I had created a whole framework and I waited months to write in a continuous integration environment, I would have had to have done like months of refactoring. So just having this framework in place, the skeleton, is going to save you a lot of time if you start off just going that way. And this is Unmesh. He's written a lot of books on Selenium for packet publishing. And he had a great quote. Basically, what you're doing in this stage of planning with your framework is you're making sure that you have goals and you have guiding principles for your teams. Because if you're doing enterprise-wide automation, it gets very, very hard. So it, you know, when I used to do automation back in the old days, it was just me with QTP. And for some reason, I thought automation ran a lot smoother. But when you scale this out to 8 to 10 sprint teams, it becomes a nightmare. So you really want to make sure you have these principles in place. Now, I'm not going to go into this in too much detail. John Summers spoke here last year at OurDev, and he has a great presentation on YouTube on creating a framework. But this is basically the same approach I used. So we use a layered approach. We use behavior-driven development. So our top-level layer here is our scenarios. And our scenarios are written in the user's language. So I work for a medical application. So our scenarios are, given I'm Dr. John, when I log into the application, when I look at my patients, then I see their exam. So it's really usable English-like syntax using GURK and your typical given when then. And this calls what I call a what step. So a what step is just a step definition. I just call it a what step, just so as our users are creating tests, they're thinking, as a user, what should this look like? So this is a really high-level, really readable API from the point of view of a user, like create patient, check exam. Nothing really codey in this layer. Nice and clean, nice clean API. And so this what step calls what I call a how step. And this how step is how you do something. So how you implement something, clicks, navigations. It gets more technical. This is where you have the code. This is where it gets in more the technical domain. And then this calls page objects, where we have all our different application pages as page objects where our Selenium element IDs are located. And so really, as you go down, it gets more technical. Your first two layers are your user layer, and then your next layers are your technical layers. So this saved us a lot of time, because in this project that was failing earlier, they had everything hard-coded in the test in what I call their what step. So that Selenium ID is all over the place. So anytime someone changed an ID, they have to touch 2,000 tests. Where if you put things in a page object and you make that change, it's only in one place. So this helps make things a lot more maintainable, a lot more reusable. Also, in theory, if we create it at the right level, I could take out Selenium and plug in, say, water. Or I could plug in LeanFT, and it wouldn't affect any of my tests or any of my what steps. Just would affect my page object. So it just allows you to be a little more flexible, where you can really expand if you had to. So this is Dave Hefner. He has a really popular Selenium newsletter. And this is a great point he brought up. He was the second guest on Test Talks. And ever since then, everyone I asked, they say, yeah, you should definitely use page objects. And the reason why is our applications are going to change over time. It's just a given. And so one way to handle that change that you know is going to happen is to use best practices or design patterns like a page object, just to make it more repeatable and more maintainable. Also, as I talked about John Samez, this is an interesting quote. Basically, when you're developing a framework, you're actually creating an application to test another application. And so the key word here is developing. So my next point is you really should have your developers, not you, your QA, build your framework. Now, you may have a killer QA person that's a killer developer. By all means, have them develop your framework. But what I've seen in general is your QA team usually is better at testing, or they may not have experience with programming. And because development and the framework is development, you should have your developers test your framework. Also, this will get them involved to let them know that they're going to be responsible for automation also. It's no longer another team that handles it. This helps promote collaboration. So you have your developers working on those lower levels that I talked about, and your QA resources can work at the higher levels. So they have a nice user API, they can start creating the test, and the developers could then implement the encode in the lower layers. This is Marcel DeVries. He does a lot with Microsoft, Microsoft Coded UI. He has a lot of courses on Pluralsight. And he brought up a good point. You do need to treat your test code just like you treat your development code. It's the same exact practices that you should use. Our team uses the same practices, the same tools as our developers. And we use code reviews, so code reviews are an awesome way to make sure that everyone's following your processes that you laid out in the framework stage. And of course, you always need to make sure that you're setting your manager's expectations. This is key because if you don't have your manager's support for automation, a lot of times they don't realize that it's a development effort. They need to know it's a development effort because development efforts, you need to maintain it over time. If you don't maintain your test over time, it's going to be a nightmare to refactor. So managers need to know this. Also, managers sometimes comes up with crazy metrics like 90% of our tests of everything is going to be automated. We're going to have 90% automation. And you have to basically do some pushback and educate them. That's not necessarily possible and necessarily a good thing. I was in an office the other day, and the manager was showing me a dashboard. And he said, look at it. We have 98% automation. And it kind of scared me because you kind of know that he's doing that to game. He's gaming the system almost. So when you have these metrics like 90%, 80% automation, a lot of times people are going to game the system. And you're really not going to get the quality that it looks like you have. So on this dashboard, it looks, wow, this team has quality. And you really don't. So Greg Pascal, he does a lot of work with SQA. And he had a great quote. As engineers, I think we're prone to say, yes, we can do it. Yeah, let's do it, definitely. But if your manager is coming up with you with some crazy expectations, it really is our job to educate them to say that that's not going to work. Let's not do that. And Goiko Adzik had a great quote. Goiko actually has a few sessions here at OrDev, so definitely check him out. And basically, when people perceive automation, some managers, sometimes they think automation, they think quality. And automation does not necessarily equal quality. I've already seen some sessions already where people said they had a lot of automation in place and the test still failed. So if you have bad manual tests and you automate them, you're just going to have a lot of bad automated tests. So it doesn't matter how many automated tests you have, if they're bad quality, it doesn't necessarily mean quality. So this is a big point, and a lot of people I don't think about is testability. If you're going to use automation, if you're using continuous integration, I think you really do need automation in place to help you. As your developers are committing more and more to the code base, you want to run tests really quickly and give them the feedback, let them know whether or not your test failed. So if your tests are not testable, if your code is not testable, if you're waiting to the end of your sprint to code or automate it, you're going to be in a big trouble there. So you really need your developers to be thinking about testability from the beginning, from the requirement stage, thinking about how can we make this more testable? How can we make it more automatable? Can I expose an API that a tool can use later on to help interrogate this application? Am I using unique IDs that will help my test tool interact with this application better? So testability is a key to being successful with automation. This is Janet Gregory. She wrote a book with Lisa Crispin, Agile Testing. And she brought up a great point on episode 34 of Test Talks, where she said, it really is a whole team approach. It's gone are the days where you had a separate QA group that handled all this. Devs and QAs really are merging together now, devs and testers. And you really need the whole team committed to testability and testing in order to be successful. Just having a person that does automation at the end of your sprint, you're not going to be very successful. Here's another great point from Kellyanne Ray-Okanda. He works for Gallup. They do a lot of implementations around the world for automation. And he brought up a good point. You know, you may be able to build an app, but are you able to test it? And I don't think many teams actually ask that question from the requirement stage. Is this going to be testable? If it's not testable, then, like I said, as we move to more continuous integration, continuous delivery, you're going to have a problem getting your code out the door because you do need automated tests to help test your application as you're moving towards that model. And once again, Marcel DeVries, this is a great point. You know, when you work on a Scrum team, your definition of done should have this as part of your story. And I go as far to say is if you have a developer that changes, say, a login page in your application code, not your framework, it's their responsibility to go in the framework and make that change within that page object. That's how much developers need to be involved with automation. So once you set your manager's expectations, you have a framework, and it's all testable, then you get into the writing phase. And so here's a great quote from Alan Page. He works at Microsoft. He worked on Xbox recently. And I think this is a true statement. 90% of the time, 90% of the people write bad GUI automation. And there's a lot of reasons for this. And a lot of times, a GUI test is not necessarily the right type of test to write. For example, if you're writing a lot of REST services and you have a page that consumes that REST service, I've seen teams that you have 20 tests that go through the UI to test that REST service. You need to test the UI, but you may have one journey test that tests the UI from a user perspective. But your other tests you can do under the covers with the REST test. And the benefit of that, it runs quicker, faster, you get quicker feedback, and they tend to be more reliable. When I first started my performance testing automation career, I started as a performance tester. And we were able to ramp up hundreds and thousands of users using a tool like LoadRunner, where you just capture the interaction between the browser and the application. And the reason why was it was headless. So GUI automation, you do need it, but I would focus more on unit integration tests, REST tests. And if you are doing UI tests, don't do a big blown out GUI test. Do something that's specific so when it fails, you know why it fails. So here's Jim Evans. No one can blame Jim Evans of not liking UI tests. He is the main contributor to the Selenium.NET bindings. He also handles the IE driver. And he brought up a great point. When he hears people telling them they have thousands and thousands of Selenium tests, he gets a little worried and says, it's probably an indication you're trying to do too much with Selenium. And here's the main contributor to Selenium. And I definitely agree with him here. So this brings us up to test size. So a lot of people at this point usually think of a test pyramid, where your traditional unit test as the base of your pyramid, your integration test, and then your GUI test at the front. But I like to think more in test size, and test size being just test being fast. So I understand you do need UI tests, but if you have a UI test, make it as fast as possible. Don't do these end-to-end journeys. Like I said, because when it fails, you want to know why it fails. Also, you want to get feedback as quickly to your developers as possible, and the best way to do that is with the fast test. And unit tests, integration tests tend to be faster. Also, if you're into Star Wars, notice that Yoda is the smallest test size, and they tend to be the most powerful, too. So as you get up, UI tests can be very evil, and they can drive you crazy. So I know you need them, but just be careful. So here's a great quote from Danielle Louise Warman. She works at ASOS, which is a fashion company. And she had a great quote where one of her biggest lessons she learned in testing was to just analyze the tests they have already and make sure that they have coverage there. If they had coverage at a unit test, why write a UI test? A lot of teams still will write a UI test for this, and there's no need for it. So if it's covered at the UI test, at the unit level, you don't need a GUI test. If it's covered at the integration level, don't write a UI test. Like I said, you probably need a few users' journey test, but if it's covered at a lower level, stay with that. Johan Halaby, he wrote one of my favorite frameworks of all time, Rest Assured, which tests REST services within Java. And he had a great point. Probably a side effect if you're writing a lot of UI tests is that maybe your developers aren't developing your application at the right level. If they were developing it at the right level, you probably would be able to write smaller type tests because they broke it out correctly. And like I said, with smaller tests, they're easy to run, much faster feedback. Also, Rob Frizzle, he wrote a book on Phantom.js. And this is a great point also. What his team does is they write a lot of the tests using Phantom.js, which is like a headless browser. And the reason why they do this is to reduce the amount of tests they have to do with a regression test. So here's one technique you can use to kind of get away from that heavy UI test. So readability. Once again, this may seem trivial, but if you work with many teams, 8 to 10 sprint teams, if everyone's writing tests their own way, they're using their own method names, they're using their own approach, and you need to maintain your framework, it's going to be a pain. Also, if you're contributing to the framework, if you see a method that exists that does something you don't understand what it is, you're going to write your own method. And then over time, you're going to have 8 to 10 sprint teams having their own methods that do the same thing because no one took the time to read it. It wasn't really readable. And so that's going to be a problem because you want to keep things dry. Don't repeat yourself. Have one place that you do changes. When you have multiple things doing the same thing, it becomes a maintenance nightmare. So readability goes a long way in making this happen. I do it myself. If I look at a class and I don't understand it, I might write my own thing. A good flag to know whether or not you're writing your test at the right level is that if you see a lot of comments, it's probably an indication that you're really not writing your code in a readable way. If you're saying this is a patient name and you have foo as a variable name, name foo patient name. I've seen teams that do this all the time, and they'll just have a comment where they could have just written the variable name in a way that was more readable. So Corey House has a lot of courses on Pluralsight. He has one called Clean Code, which I applied in my framework. And really, naming has a huge impact on the readability of your code. You need to know what the programmer's intent is as soon as you read that code. And a great point he brought up also is that you spend more time reading code than you do writing code. So you should put the effort in to really write your tests in a readable way, your code in a readable way. John Summers, another great point is you really should be able to look at your tests and code and say, I totally understand what's going on here. If you don't have that feeling, you understand what's going on, probably you're not writing it at the right level. So this is a little hard to read, but this is an actual example of that first group I was talking about. Now, they were doing behavior-driven development the completely wrong way. They were using it as an automation framework, and you're losing the value of BDD, which is collaboration. So you can see they have this hard-coded integration-type steps as, like, as a user, they're clicking on things. You shouldn't have clicks. You should just have as-a-user-type information. And also, they have hard-coded here a lot of Selenium IDs. So anytime a test or someone changed an application ID, you had to touch all your tests to make the changes. Also, this is what I would call your what step. So when you first go in here, if you're not a developer, you may not have no idea what's going on. So you're really alienating half your people on your sprint team that can help contribute to the automation effort. And also, even if you're a developer, you need to kind of look at it and go, OK, I'm instantiating this variable, and I'm doing the switch statement. So after our first refactor, I think this is a little more readable. It's still not perfect, but this is with the readable API, where you know it's a toolbar, and you're clicking on a button ID within that toolbar. A lot more readable than this, I think. Here's another great point, is that a lot of teams don't do this. As when you're writing automated tests, you want to make sure you're able to see them fail. If you don't see them fail, how do you know that when they're passing, they're really passing for the right reason? So this is like test-driven development. You can create your automation framework in a way that you use TDD for your development efforts. And make sure you're seeing it fail, so when it does pass, you have the confidence in knowing that it's really going to catch real issues. And actually, a lot of guests on Test Talks has brought this up. John Samez brought up a good point that if a test has never failed, it's worthless. The test that doesn't fail is worthless. You may have 1,000 tests, but if they never test, what's the point? And if you've never seen a test fail, how do you know it's going to? Also, Alan Page, once again, the more he could trust his failing test, the more he can trust his passing test. We had a team that had a lot of unit tests, and they were held up as like, look at this team with all these unit tests, wow. And they were all passing, they were all fast. And a year later, we put in a tool called Test Advisor. And Test Advisor is able to analyze your code and notice the unit tests weren't doing anything. 80% of the unit tests weren't doing anything. But if you looked on that dashboard, it would have shown they had like 90% automation coverage at the unit level, and it was useless. So if you don't see a test fail, how are you going to have the confidence? Make sure you know that it's failing and you're able to catch real failures. So this brings us to the execution phase. So this is my grandmother. And my grandmother was an Italian grandmother from southern Italy. So picture a short woman with a handkerchief around her head, really old. And she didn't speak any English, and she was a little bit crazy. So when my mom took her grocery shopping, I had to go and keep my eye on her. So she'd be in the grocery produce section, squeezing and smelling all the fruits and vegetables. So she'd be knocking on the cantaloupes, smelling the tomatoes, squeezing the apricots. And if those fruits and vegetables didn't meet my grandmother's smell test, they didn't go in her carriage. So she was really being like a Jedi, using the Force to get feedback to say, is this fruit good? Is it bad? And the reason why I bring this up is a lot of times people don't realize that your tests are the same way. Your tests give you this feedback. If your tests are slow, if they're failing all over the place, they're most likely telling you something. Once again, I had a team. Our tests were failing intermittently. So they were saying, oh, your tests are flaky. We're just going to ignore them. And it turned out the application had a bug in it where it was randomly not putting the application in the right state. So, of course, the tests were failing. But no one were paying attention to the tests. They weren't trusting the tests. Listen to your tests. Don't just throw more hardware at the issue and maybe a more serious issue underlining what's happening. So I think everyone has experienced flaky tests. You can sometimes never trust your test. But I think if we follow some of the things we talked about already, we can make them a little bit more maintainable, more repeatable. But I think there's a lot of reasons why tests can be flaky and behave this way. So controlled environments. Here's one that happens all the time. I don't know why, but it's like a theme I hear all the time. Is you'll be running your tests in an environment, and you think it's a secured shutdown environment, and your tests stop failing. And you don't know why they're failing, so you rerun them, and they pass. And it turns out you had a QA person in here turning off services. And you didn't know, turning them off. So when you ran your test, they failed. And when you turn it back on, it passed, but you never knew why it was happening. If you worked on a lot of sprint teams across the world, you have no idea what people are doing. So a lot of times, not having a controlled environment will kill your testing efforts. And it's a very easy thing to fix. So whenever I think of test data management, I don't know why. It's just the way I think. I think of Hermie the elf. I don't know if anyone's seen Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, but his catchphrase was always, I'm independent. And that's what your tests really need to be. Your tests need to be independent. They need to be able to run atomically on their own without any dependency on any other tests that go before them. I see a lot of people writing their behavior-driven development tests this way with their scenarios, with one scenario relying on another scenario to run, and this is a nightmare. Every test should be atomic. They should set up the data they need and clean the data after they're done. If you don't do it this way, you're going to have a lot of headaches. You don't want to maintain a spreadsheet saying, I need to run this test and that test before this test. Especially if you want to run in parallelization, run on multiple machines, if you have to stop managing data, it's going to be a nightmare. And so Seb Rose, he wrote the book on Java Cucumber, and he brought up a great point that, you know, he can't stress enough how important it is for test data management. Also, the benefit of using automation is you can run it against multiple environments. So if your tests are self-contained, what we do is we run tech tests. So we'll change out the back end of our application and run a subset of our tests to see how things are running. And because they're atomic and they're independent, we're able to get that coverage and reuse of our automation scripts, where if they're not independent and atomic, you use half the benefit of automated tests. Oh, another big point is synchronization. So a lot of times your tests will be failing, flaky, all over the place. And a lot of times I think people just assume that their application or their elements are going to be in the right state before they interact with them. And that's a big, big problem. Also, I work, unfortunately, for a project that only officially supports is Internet Explorer, but you can run the test against Chrome and Firefox. So what do you think everyone does when they're developing? They use Chrome and Firefox. And Chrome and Firefox runs a lot faster than IE. It generates the DOM quicker. So the tests hardly ever fail. They get to continuous integration, and they stop failing because we're using IE, and they're blaming the test, they're blaming the tool, they're blaming everything, but they didn't do any sort of synchronization within their tests. So synchronization, you want to make sure you're using explicit weights to say, before you click on something, is it clickable? Before you interact with an element, is it present? If you don't have that in place, it's going to be an issue. Also, what I've seen a lot of people do is use thread.sleeps, which is a hard weight. And like I said, if you're running in a continuous integration environment, you need your tests to run quickly. And if you have hard-coded 5 seconds all over the place in your test scripts and you're running them in your test suite, it's going to add time. Believe me, it adds up over time, and it doesn't make sense. You should use more of an explicit wait that says, is this present? And if it's present within, say, 2 seconds, it continues rather than waiting a hard wait of 5-10 seconds. So Alan Richardson, he's written a lot of great books on Java for Testers is a great book. If you're not familiar with automation, with testing in Java, he also has a lot of training on Udemy, on Selenium. And this is a great point. For synchronization, you really want to make sure, like I said, that before you interact with something, you interrogate it, you want to make sure that it's present. Before you manipulate it, make sure that it's clickable. Don't make any assumptions. Always be proactive when you're writing your test to make sure that you're checking to make sure they're in a known state before you're continuing. This will drive you crazy if you don't do it, because sometimes it'll pass, sometimes it'll fail, and you won't really know. So if you wait till after the fact, you may not think, oh, I forgot to do a check for this before. So eventually, your tests are going to fail. The point is, when they do fail, you need to be able to tell why they failed. So this happens to me all the time. We'll have a test suite that are failing, and we'll have 20 tests that failed. And so if you have a lot of tests, and they run every night in your continuous integration environment, and it takes you a day to find out why something failed, a developer's already pushed new code, and they're already running a new build, and your tests are running against that build, you've already lost a day of effort, and you've lost the battle. If you have to actually start debugging your tests and stepping through it, you're going to have an issue. So mean time to diagnosis is really key. When the test fails, you need to know why did it fail as quickly as possible. So using some sort of login mechanism, we started messing around with something called Elasticsearch and Logstash, which is a really cool tool that allows you to see flakiness over time and gives you a nice dashboard view of seeing how your tests are behaving. This is really key, like I said, to maintaining tests and making sure if you're the one responsible for these tests, you're able to tell why it failed, when it failed, as quickly as possible. So once again, this is Alan Page. I think he brought up a great point. When a test fails, how long does it take you to figure out how long it failed? this is actually where I got this concept out of. Like I said, Alan Page works at Microsoft, and this is something that he's seen. Actually, one of the only metrics that really makes sense for automation that's very helpful for him and his teams. So your tests are going to fail. So it depends how you're going to handle these failing tests in your continuous integration environments. So there's a lot of approaches for this. The worst one is the red one, where you automatically rerun failing tests. So I spoke to Steve Hazel from Sauce Labs, and he said a lot of companies actually do this. So if a test fails, they just rerun it, and that's fine. You may want to keep track of that to see which tests you have to constantly retest over time, because you're going to want to refactor it to see why it's flaky. I think the best one is the green one, but another thing you do is quarantine a test. Running tests in CI is a privilege. So what I do is I tag them as flaky, and it's just for a time, and I'll run them in a separate environment. So it'll separate out our tests that we know run well. They'll run in the continuous integration environment every night, and then we have another environment where we run our flaky test, and then we maintain them that way. So whenever a test starts passing consistently within the flaky test environment, we take away that tag, and automatically gets promoted to our main build that runs every night. So that's another way you can handle failing tests. I think the best way is to delete a test, right? If it's failing for 48 hours and developers don't care, you don't care, it tells me if you don't fix it in 48 hours, it's not an important test. I was at a conference, I think this is what Microsoft does. They'll actually delete the test after 24 hours, I think. So it's pretty extreme. My group won't let me do this, but I would love to do this. So if you can do this, I would say delete the test. If it's in version control, you can always get it back anyway. So here's a really famous issue, blaming your tools for everything. So don't blame your tools. I had a group that had a bunch of QTP tests written in QuickTest Professional, and they've been running for a year. And after a year, they had a lot of tests. They were running flaky. They were slow. They were unreliable. So the solution was, we're going to go to all open source tools. So we're going to use Selenium. And that's going to fix all the issues. So a year later, I talked to this team. Guess what happened? They have a bunch of flaky tests that are slow, that don't work. So I heard that this manager recently said, we need to stop doing BDD. BDD is not working because our tests are failing. And I've never heard a developer say, we need to move from C# to Java. That'll fix everything. But for some reason, we tend to go and say, let's switch test tools. That'll resolve everything. All these underlying issues we talked about apply to QuickTest Professional, Selenium, Test Complete, any automation framework. It's just best practices that we use for development is the same you use for automation. And refactoring. For some reason, I think people think refactoring is a bad word. I love refactoring. As your tests run, you're going to notice that maybe you didn't write it optimally the first time. You got feedback. Say a bug went into production and you found out what the bug was and you said, should this test have fixed it? If so, fix the test. If it didn't, add a test that handles it. But refactoring is key to making your test maintainable over time. Like I said, it's an automation. Automation is a development effort. If you don't treat it as a development effort, you're going to have issues if you just let your tests run over time and never maintain them. And so this is also a constant theme I've been hearing. Sahas, in this episode, made a great point. A lot of times, your product moved on and your code moved on. You maintain your code base, but you didn't maintain your test cases. So why wouldn't it fail? Why are we surprised when our tests stop failing after a year when we never maintained them, we never refactored them, we never took care of them and pruned them back? It's just common. You should maintain your tests over time. You should build this into your sprint teams, let them know there's going to be maintenance over time of your test, and that it's part of the development cycle, and you have to do it in order to be successful. And also, Alan Richin makes up a good point, is that if you don't refactor, you're building up tech debt, and you have to be aware of that. So if your product owner has a choice between creating more features or automating some of your manual tests, they're always going to choose the features. They're never going to choose the automated test. So you want to keep on top of it as soon as possible. Always refactor, always make your automated tests a lot better. So I actually got through this a lot quicker than I ever have in my demos. So I think it's important to recognize that test automation is a real development effort. And I think if we focus on these three phases of planning, writing, and execution of your automation scripts, I think we can all make automation more awesome for everyone involved. I know I had a lot of references in this presentation, so I created a webpage. So if you go to joecolantonio.com/ordev, I'll have a list of all the episodes of my podcast and everything else that I talked about in this presentation. And you can also hit me up on Twitter at joecolantonio. Thank you for your time. Appreciate it.
Cool. So for links to everything of value that I talked about in this presentation, head on over to testtalks.com/83. And while you're there, click on the Sign Up Now button under the exclusive sponsor section to learn all about Sauce Labs' awesome products and services. And since this is only 6 days away from Christmas, a great gift to give me, if you haven't already, is to go out and rate and review Test Talks in iTunes. Ratings and reviews really help in the rankings of the show, and I appreciate all your feedback to help make Test Talks even better. So that's it for this episode of Test Talks. I'm Joe, and my mission is to help you succeed with automation awesomeness. As always, test everything and keep the good. Happy holidays. Cheers.
Thanks for listening to the Test Talks podcast. Head on over to www.testtalks.com for full show notes, amazing blog articles, and other automation awesomeness.